Welcome to Word on the Rock. I'm Mary Lowry, and this week's guest is Gillian Campbell. Her new book is coming out in September. It has already come out, and will be coming out in the States too. It's called The Apple House. Gillian Campbell grew up in Pointe-Claire, Quebec, and attended l'Université de Montréal, but she's lived in various parts of Canada. Kitchener, Montreal, South Porcupine in Northern Ontario, Vancouver and Terrace in BC, as well as in England. She's worked as a librarian and as a childcare worker. She currently lives on Salt Spring. Five of her short stories have been published: The Butcher, Distance Education, A Revolution in the Dark, The Man Who Couldn't Swim, and Life After Death. This is her first full-length novel. So, Gillian, can you tell us how it feels to be a published novelist? It's a huge achievement.
Well, it's very exciting, mm-hmm. And a little discombobulating at the same time, mm-hmm. kind of a shock to the system. After all those hours of sitting at the desk and forcing myself not to have too many fantasies about, you know, publication and instant fame, etc. But it's a lot of fun.
Well, why is it discombobulating?
Well, it's just, it's kind of an upheaval because I guess I didn't let myself think about it too much. And it's sort of a whole new thing. There is the book is outside of myself now. It's kind of like, I don't know, a little bit like having a child, a grown-up child. There they are, they're outside of you. You still feel responsible, and yet there's really nothing you can do anymore. Right. They're on their own, so that's a little bit how I feel about the
right.
book. It's great, though. I like that part. I like having it
out
done,
there.
Out there, yeah.
Yeah. I've always felt that as a parent of the umbilical cord is never completely broken. Do you think it's the same way for a book?
I think it is. I mean, if I do dip into it, I certainly immediately think, oh, I want to change a word. But at the same time, you know, I like the idea that the umbilical cord is broken. I'm glad I can't change anything.
I think that happens too with the other one. Yes.
I think also, well, in life, the child is happy. The book, I guess, can't really think.
Well, would you like to give the listeners an idea of what the story is about?
Well, it's set in Quebec. It's about a woman living in a small French village near Montreal, and she's an Anglophone. She was married to a French boy from the village. But as the story opens, he's been killed. So we start with her as a widow, and she's in a state of shock. They had been running a shoe store. It was an old historic shoe store that had been in his family for generations.
Mm-hmm.
And she's left with this, and she basically feels she can't cope. And one of the things, apart from her grief, that, you know, stops her from coping is that she finds suddenly that she cannot understand or speak French, which she has learned to do over the years. And this is because he died. They were both in a car accident.
Mm-hmm.
And so this trauma, and she goes home to her, runs home to her parents, where she finds that it's not quite that simple.
No, it's not. What first drew you into writing the work?
Well, I think it's something that probably had been sort of, you know, cogitating in my mind. It's a memory of a childhood memory, actually. It was how I started, because I grew up in a very similar setting as the book, really. And I had a memory of an old house on the corner of our street that was kind of a ramshackle place, totally surrounded by junk, cast-off belongings. And the house belonged to a farmer who had sold off his land, the land in very fact where I was going to grow up in a suburban house. And they were going through their stuff, getting rid of it, and about to move on. And I remember as a child just looking at all these things and wanting to go and get some, which I did not do. But in the story, which has quite a lot to do with Imogen is her name, her childhood.
Right.
This is one thing that happens. Some children go on a raid.
Right. Can you read us a part of that where
this Yes, okay. There's a part. It's kind of a flashback, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so the children, there's four children. Imo is our heroine, I guess, and then she has three friends, three boys. And they are they're basically spying on this mm-hmm. farmhouse and waiting for a time when they can go and investigate everything. And so I'll read to you a little part just before they do that. Maybe Imo. It is a good job for a girl, I think, says Finny. Rupert seizes on this suggestion. She can stay here, out of the way, and whistle if someone comes, once for the farmer, two for the goat. Imo feels her heart pumping. I don't have to, and you can't make me. She knows what she wants, and it's there on the sodden yellow grass waiting for her. The Victrola is a beautiful thing, the first she has ever set eyes on, but she knows what it is, because she has studied a picture in a magazine. The funnel is where the sound comes out, and sticking out the side of the wooden base, though hidden from her view, there is a small metal handle for winding it up. In the pictures, there is always a brown and white dog with an ear cocked to listen. Her own black spaniel, Tilly, can surely be persuaded to do the same. Charlie lays a restraining arm across her shoulder. He has his eye on the toboggan, a six-seater, and the longest he has ever seen. Imo feels the heat of her friend's body against her own, and the soft whistle of his breath as he whispers into her ear, "Not yet, Imo." But Imo has lost patience. She knows that Rupert and Finny don't care about Victrolas or toboggans or any of the farmer's cast-offs. They would be happy with an old boot for a trophy. There is nothing they would like better than to waste the day scheming and dreaming and thinking up ever more complicated plans. Imo hates plans. They evoke the possibility that something will go wrong, that she will be caught by the farmer and dangled over the edge of the veranda, or worse, fed to the goat. Above all, she is afraid of the billy. She knows, too, deep down inside, that if she takes the Victrola, she will be stealing. And it's better not to think about that.
Yeah.
I'll stop there, yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of interesting that it's kind of on that borderland, and I think a few of your characters are on that borderland, but we'll come to that later. That's where she starts out, but it doesn't stay as a story for a young girl, does it?
No, it really alternates between her Imogen as an adult and Imo, as she's called, as a child. Mm-hmm. So we start off with her recently widowed, and then she moves back home, and the story does go back into her more recent life. Mm-hmm. And then also into her childhood. Yeah, the childhood sections are quite separate.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
One of the things I noticed about a lot of your characters and about Imogen in particular is that she, unlike most protagonists, doesn't seem to have a clearly defined goal that she's pursuing. Am
yes,
I right?
We talked about that, and it was a bit of a shock to me, actually. I thought, oh no. But you're quite right. And I think it's probably not that unusual for many people. She's just coping, and she's a bit buffeted by sort of the winds or whatever happens to her. She does appear as a child to be much more focused, I think. But as an adult, she, well, she falls in love with someone, of course.
Yes.
But she also has a great fascination for the village.
Yes.
But, and I guess most of the characters are like that. But I like to think that Imogen has developed a focus by the end.
Yes, I think she does. I think the fact that she doesn't have this very strong... the atmosphere of the book is very much one of a world I felt I recognized, you know, although I've never lived in Quebec. And one of the things I liked about the book was a sense of a particular place and a community, a whole variety of characters that live there. But do you see life yourself as being kind of without a clear goal? Or?
Well, I think it's important to have a goal in life, certainly for all of us. But sometimes I think people get, even if they do have a goal, they can easily sort of step sideways. In conversations, you know, I mean, I guess as one gets older, I've had conversations with friends saying, well, you know, I was so intent on doing something or other, and now I can't even imagine why, you know.
Right.
So I think it's good to have a goal. I'm not saying that it isn't. I think
right.
It's, but,
it's good. It's a good one, right.
I think often society has goals for us.
Well, I guess if you hadn't expected someone to see Imogen as not without clear goals...
Well, that's very interesting, that observation, though. Yeah,
right.
It's quite true.
That's right. I did sort of wonder if... Because we're sort of exploring with Imogen. Do you find that when you're writing, you actually have a clear goal and you can go for it? Or do you find that somehow or other... it's not as clearly defined as one might expect.
Well, I think the thing is that it keeps changing. I have, like, very clear goal, but it doesn't... until the next week, something will happen.
Right.
And then I'll have set up another clear goal. So I made a lot of... I made a lot of little outlines. But the character, I mean, it's sort of a cliché that the character takes over, you know.
Right.
But... it does. I think that really happens if you try to get into someone's head.
Right.
And then some things seem possible or some things seem in character and some things don't. So I think that's what happens.
Right, right.
And then at the end, we try to impose a goal.
Yeah. Welcome back to Word on the Rock. I'm Mary Lowry and I'm in the studio at CFSI with Gillian Campbell. Her book, The Apple House, has just come out here and in the United States. So, Gillian, another thing I liked about your book was that there were three beautifully contrasted places acting as a setting. We have a lot of action in La Violette's shoe shop. We have one at Gardner Crescent, which you actually called Croissant Jardinier,
yes.
Which I thought was kind of funny, and the Apple House of the title. How important were the settings for the telling of Imogen's story?
Well, they were very important to me. They seemed critical, I guess, because I was writing a little bit out of the past and a lot from memory. So that, I guess this is a kind of story that maybe could have happened somewhere else. But for Imogen, the character, I felt it was sort of integral to her experiences were so involved with the setting, particularly of, well, the house and the Apple House and the village. I think that's probably true of a lot of stories, though. Yeah. But the village part, she's very fascinated by the village.
And it provides a wonderful opportunity for a whole variety of characters, really interesting characters. We've got the Chaputz, which is a grandfather who's got an artificial leg.
Ah, yes.
Who's there as a remote and strange character for Imogen. And Imogen relates to him in a very interesting way as well. She sees him at the Apple House, but she often sees him in her dreams, doesn't she?
She does. She's taken something that belongs to him, mm-hmm. and so she has some guilt. I mean, she's I guess terribly proud that she's been able to done this. She's gone on her raid, as we read a bit about the preliminaries of that.
Right.
But she really she doesn't have a good understanding of whether he needs this leg.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't tell you that, right? She's taken his leg.
She
stole his artificial leg.
Yes.
Not one that he uses.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't understand, She thinks maybe he could. Should I read a bit about that? Or?
Oh, that would be lovely.
Okay. I've got it here. Now I've marked it.
Mm-hmm.
This takes place after the raid, quite some time on.
Mm-hmm.
And she's taken this. It's a peg leg, and she's taken it in great triumph.
Mm-hmm.
But as the days go by, she's not so sure about it, and she has bad dreams.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this basically the bad dreams are what push her to want to give it back. And so here she is, once again spying on the farmhouse. The old man steps onto the veranda and walks with short, jerky steps, like a wind-up grandfather, thinks Immo, to the overstuffed platform rocker. His body cracks in the middle and slowly sinks from sight until all that is left of him is the tip of a blue beret and his artificial leg sticking straight out from the chair, the ankle glinting in the sun. Immo wonders if he knows she is there, crouched behind the stone pillar watching him, or if perhaps from the padded depths of the rocker he is spying on her. She picks at the scab on her elbow to make sure she is awake. In her dreams, the old man limps around the farmhouse yard, poking through the piles of cast-offs, searching for his leg, which is still in the culvert, waterlogged now and swollen, jammed in tight by debris and spring mud, and blocking the flow of water. The farmer's field has turned into a lake that even the goat dares not cross. And every night, in Imo's dreams, Papa Chaput stands at the water's edge and calls her name. I'll stop there.
That's right. And, of course, the fact that she steals his leg gives her a very scary experience later on, which the listeners will have to find out about in the book, I think.
Yes. Even scarier.
But it does actually disturb her quite a lot too. I notice there's no living angel in the story. The characters are all sort of on this borderline that you mentioned. Of morality,
they're ordinary.
They're like most of us, right?
Yeah.
But there is a clear bad guy, Sven. So, would you like to talk a little bit about Sven?
Sven is he is a bad guy, actually. He's a drug dealer, really. But he's not. It's totally effective. One has a feeling that, and he's basically at odds with Imogen the whole time, but he's also, unfortunately, from her point of view, very good friends, kind of a former foster brother of her husband.
Right.
And he's a boy from the village. Well, he's a boy from an orphanage, but so was Imogen's husband. And people, even though he doesn't behave well, the people in the village, all those quirky characters you mentioned, kind of take him with a grain of salt. They put up with him. Because they know him, but she's not comfortable with him at all.
No.
So he's I'm not sure what to say about him. He's whether he's redeemable or not. He seems to get worse as the go.
And he does show up something about not so attractive about Imogen's character as well, doesn't he? Her attitude to him is...
Yeah, she's somewhat aware, or certainly as she looks back, she's aware that perhaps she could have handled things differently. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of a triangle going on.
Yes, yes, there is. Yes, that's right. I noticed from your website that as a librarian, you made papier-mâché puppets and you used them for oral storytelling. How has that experience played into your writing of fiction? Did it help in any way? Or?
Well, I think I did a lot of puppet shows. I loved puppet shows. I think what it did was it was kind of instead of writing, it allowed me to make the stories my own.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, you know, I did a lot of fairy tales and things, and they changed a lot. So, so I think I graduated from that to writing.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Gillian, for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes. And for the listeners out there, there's going to be a book launch of Apple House at the Lions Club on November the 15th. It's a Thursday at 7 o'clock. So we do hope that you'll be able to make it to that. And she also has a website, www.gilliancampbell.ca. Is that
right.
Correct?
That's right, yes.
That's correct. That's right. The book launch will be in... it will be two books that are being launched. One is Marilyn Horsdall's book, The Judge and the Lady, which...
Right.
And she will be on Word on the Rock later this season. Next week, Patrick Taylor is going to be in conversation with Kathy Hudson about his book, A Country Wedding. We have one other announcement to make, and it's about A Night of Fiction that's being presented by Theatre Alive. It's a literary evening and coffee house at Marne Hall with Peggy Herring and Chris Smart. Peggy Herring has just put out a book called This Innocent Corner, and Chris Smart has put out Decked and Dancing. It's going to be on Saturday, October the 27th at 7:30. And thank you for joining us all at CFSI Word on the Rock. And thank you once again, Gillian. And thank you to Cindy Jacobson, who has been doing our technical work here for us and holding the show together.
Thank you to Salt Spring Books on McPhillips Avenue for sponsoring Word on the Rock and helping spread the wealth of literature to our friends and neighbors on the island.
This is David Hart, and you're listening to Salt Spring Radio, CFSI FM, on either 107.9 or 102.1 FM. Online, you can catch us at cfsi-fm.com.